were promising people ponies, and she would say, where are the ponies going to come from? How are we going to pay for the ponies? Will Washington, you know, agree? Or are we going to regulate the ponies? And you would say, Hillary Clinton hates ponies.
It's Friday, September 15th, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. For those of you who've been listening to the show as of late, you'll notice once again, we have a decline in quality today. Sorry about that. Looks like my internet has been out for a couple days, so we've jerry-rigged a little setup here, so hopefully this is going to come across okay. On today's show, well, Bernie Sanders introduces single-payer bill with 16 co-sponsors, just in time for some perspective on what happened. The party get the Sanders bump and move significantly to the left? It's looking like it. All I know is that I want my pony. In the wake of Harvey and Irma, now is exactly the time to talk about climate change. Kay Aronoff is burning it up over at The Intercept in the wake of the catastrophic hurricanes. We're watching disaster capitalism in real time, folks. Trump deepens his relationship with Chuck and Nancy. More like a booty call, really. Trump's voting fraud commission continues to expose how Kris Kobach plans to suppress the vote in 2018 and 2020. Fearless girl gets blue ribbon and Wall Street bull doused with blue paint in protest of climate denial. Crude bomb goes off on London Tube this morning. And Harvard invites them and then disinvites Chelsea Manning to be a visiting fellow, thanks to Mike Pompeo and the spineless dean of Harvard's Kennedy School Institute of Politics. David Freed, Cumberland County DA, nominated to U.S. Attorney Office. Maybe he'll be bringing his binders full of white supremacists, you know, for jobs, you know. The Intercept picks up coverage of Evan McLaren, too. Wolf votes for fracking moratorium in Delaware River Basin Commission, which is odd since he's promoting fracking everywhere else in the state. PA House Republicans approves budget filled with gimmicks and cuts to environmental programs. I may want my pony, but PA House Republicans are trafficking in unicorns. In today's last call, Chris Robay on his new book, Breaking the Spell, A History of Anarchist Filmmakers, Videotape Gorillas, and Digital Ninjas was at Kutztown University yesterday. I'll tell you a little bit about his appearance, and hopefully we're going to be getting him on the program for an Out the Coop Extra. Today, we say goodbye to Cassini in our last call. Yes, Cassini is no more as it plunged into Saturn early this morning, which I could not see because my internet is down. Sax releases bloopers video, which was a blast to watch. And Sean gets his hand in a crawler video. This might be his big break, folks. That and so much more. There's a reminder to tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I won't be on this week. I had some stuff I had to take care of, and it kind of conflicted with our recording time. But please check out the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV. You can stream the show live at 7 p.m. Eastern at freespeech.org, or you can tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or with the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, no problem. Go to thericksmithshow.com and click on the free speech icon in the sidebar. I need you to keep pull no punches progressive media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to ragingchickenpress.org and look for the support and membership tab. Click become a member and you're on your way. A member, no problem. You can make a one-time donation by clicking donate. Remember, we still have our back-to-school special going strong. If you join now through October at the $10 a month level, we'll send you a copy of Mark Bray's new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And, you know, just become a member today and we'll send you that. If you don't want the book, hey, look, that's no problem. We still got something for you. We'll send you an official Raging Chicken Press Stay Woke coffee mug instead. So there you have it. So, Sean, I'm glad we were able to actually jerry-rig this thing up, and hopefully the sound quality won't be too bad today.
Yeah, I'm glad, too. I know. I'm just trying to wonder what's happening over there. Did you forget to pay your bills or something, or is this like the world we're going to be seeing with without net neutrality?
Yeah, you know, I don't – actually, what happened was, you know, I think they got word that I was going to be like live streaming 24/7 the Cassini plunge into the Saturn's atmosphere, and they decided to shut me down. No, it was actually, it was weird. It's like there was a power outage in Perkasie on Wednesday, and the power came back on and everything like that. But we have Verizon Fios, and that evening the phones went, TV, internet, and everything like this, and we haven't had any landline phone or internet access since. So luckily, we have a little hotspot set up on my phone that's the seems to be working and holding out for right now. But yeah, it's been strange. I've spent hours on Thursday kind of going through all the troubleshooting to try to see what was going on, but finally got to send someone out, and they weren't able to get anybody out until later on today. So good thing I don't rely on the internet for my work or anything.
Yeah.
Well, my wife and I both. I mean, we're like, usually we end up, that's what we do. You know, at nighttime we're doing work, and neither one of us could do our stuff. So
now we have to go back to what it's like living back in the 1990s.
Dude, man, I'm kind of digging it. I got to say, it's like, it's actually not bad. This is the danger. This is the real danger when they have these kind of outages, right? Is that when you spend a few days away from the internet and spend a few days away from connectivity, so to speak, you realize, it's actually not that bad. So it's not, it's gonna, it could still read books and talk to people and all sorts of stuff.
Wait, what are books?
They're the things, Let me start from Kindle and work myself backwards, and maybe you'll know. But yeah, that's what you said during college too, right?
Oh.
Oh man! So I'm glad we're able to do this though this week, because I mean we've got so much stuff, and we're barely ever even going to be able to cover a tenth of what went on. But I think front and center, I mean, I think it might be kind of a good way to start off today. The Bernie Sanders introduces a single payer bill with 16 co-sponsors. I mean, it's been really interesting to watch these dynamics this week.
Yeah, it looks like. Single payer is now mainstream within the Democratic Party.
That's what it seems like. I mean, you've got anyone who's even in the, the consideration mode for like presidential run in 2020 is signed on to this bill, which basically says. What'd you say?
I said ponies for everyone.
Yep. Ponies for all. Everyone. That's right. No, it's like, it is interesting that and at the same time that, Hillary Clinton's making her rounds for her book, What Happened. It's a real stark contrast, I think, in perspectives on where the Democratic Party should be. So on the one hand, you've got Hillary Clinton's book, What Happened, right? And her account of how, everyone else sunk the election.
Not like she forgot the campaign in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, but just
– Well, no, you know what? I've been watching some interviews because we talked a little bit about this beforehand. It's like I know some people – this will piss some people off, but whatever. I've watched carefully a lot of – well, probably about four different interviews now, and I have not read the book. So let me say that off the hand. So if you're listening to this and you have read the book and you can contradict me, please write it in the comments, because I'm trying to be clear about where I'm coming from. But what was interesting about it is that she's. What we see more than anything else is that we see, she is committed to a very specific version of what the Democratic Party is all about, right? I mean, it's kind of really this centrist position. It's crazy. And one of the things that she claims in there, this is what my point that I wanted to make, was that you talked about Michigan and Pennsylvania and so on, right? And she claims, right, and there's some truth to this, is that she personally was meeting in Michigan, was meeting in Pennsylvania, was meeting these groups all over the place and having these, you know, these small meetings and things. And, you know, I can remember when she was a candidate in New York State, you know, so I'm originally from like upstate New York. When she was a candidate up there, she did the same kind of stuff, these listening tours. And the people all across, especially kind of central New York, kind of the region of New York where I'm from, kind of anything that's away from New York City, right? They really appreciated that. It was a more conservative part of the state, but they actually voted pretty substantially for Hillary Clinton, in part because they felt it was the first time they had a politician who was listening to her. That whole kind of model really was completely drowned out by the way what was happening at two fronts. One, the media coverage of the, you know, of the clown car, number one, but then also you know, the political terrain had shifted so substantially that wasn't going to work. So on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, Hillary Clinton saying, look, I was in these places and I wasn't getting the coverage, and there's some truth to that. But the bigger point is not about her as the person. It has to do with the way that whole campaign was structured, right, on the state. So she might say we did campaign in Pennsylvania, but we know from like people on the ground in Pennsylvania that sure, they had offices in Pennsylvania, they were running some ads in Pennsylvania, but they were not getting the kind of resources and supplies from the Clinton campaign. They were turned away from them, like the national campaign. And they didn't have the ground game where people were actually going out knocking on doors until it was too late.
Yeah. And one of the things, getting back to Bernie Sanders, this is something he said he was going to do from the start of his presidential campaign. Like, this is something he said he was going to make his issue and make it into a mainstream American issue. And he's doing that. Like, he doesn't need to be president to make his issue more prominent. I mean, he's been doing this since the day he started, you know, since he started his political career back in the 1980s. Like, this is something, you know, you saw videos for people for Bernie page posted videos of him talking about universal health care back in the 1980s, the 1990s, when he was the mayor of Burlington.
Exactly.
And he's been saying the same stuff since then, and he's saying it today. You know, and he's worked. I mean, like, how significant is it that 16 of his colleagues signed on to this bill?
It's huge. I mean, it basically says like a couple things, right? It says, number one, is that the party is moving leftward, right? And I should say, by the party, I don't necessarily mean the, you know, Chuck and Nancy, but I mean like you know, where the party people see where the base is, right? So at the very least, you know, the fact that you've got Cory Booker met a privatization scheme he didn't like, right? Cory Booker signing onto this is significant, right? The fact that you got like Kamala Harris came out like almost immediately to sign onto this, right? Now that doesn't mean like I swear to God, this is the kind of thing that's going to drive me crazy. And I'll just put it on the table now, is that what the left starts to do is they start to kind of like wanting to view everything through a morality lens. Like, is Kamala Harris really believing this stuff, or is she just doing it because, you know, she needs to kind of like, you know, give lip service to it? And my response is like, who the hell cares?
She put her name on a document, and now it's time to hold her to that.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And we've been talking about that kind of dynamic for a long time. And it pisses me off when we start to see people, we lose any perspective on how you actually, you know, do politics. Right.
So,
you know, we'll use that as the opportunity now to pressure them leftward, which was the plan, by the way, of what was going to happen if Hillary had been elected. But anyways.
So getting back to your earlier comment about me not reading books, I was looking on my bookshelf and I was like, one of the books I read in college, one of my favorite books, and really like one of the idol, like one of my like revolutionary idols growing, you know, studying this stuff, is Carlos Fonseca from the Nicaraguan Revolution and the Sandinista Revolution. And, you know, like the stuff he pushed for, it's not like it's like Trotsky or Marx or anything like that. I mean, like, he wrote the Sandinista Manifesto and he held people to that. I mean, this is your founding document as a movement. This is your manifesto. You know, now it's time to like hold people to this. And I mean, Sanders has been doing this since day one. And one of the things, you know, get talking to about like Clinton and what happened, you know, she makes a point that she's like center right, center left. Yeah, she went center right. She pandered to Republicans who were endorsing her. Like, you know, she had a whole entire webpage. We talked about this about over a year ago, about her starting a Tumblr page full of neocons from Pennsylvania who supported her, like Tom Ridge, anyone else who was in that neocon wing of the Republican Party, that war hawk, chicken hawk wing of the Republican Party that endorsed her from this state. She was pandering to them as a way to get votes from Republicans, from centrist Republicans. You know, she was chasing the mythical unicorn. While we wanted our ponies, she was going after the unicorns. And look how that happened. You know, unicorns don't exist.
No, exactly. But I think here's where I'm going to push back a little bit on how you frame that, right? Is that while I agree that was true, I would say it's not simply a matter of Hillary Clinton, right? What that represented, that was the playbook, right, from the corporate Democratic wing. The, you know, the dying throes, right, of the Democratic Leadership Council, right?
Also, like with Bill Clinton chastising exactly. College students, telling them to get with the program. You're all disillusioned. You don't know what you're talking about when they said they wanted student loan debt relief and free public higher education. You know, like yep. These are probably one of the two biggest millennial issues right now, you know, crushing student debt and the need for free public higher education. And he basically called them a bunch of disillusioned, you know, people who swung the election the other way in 2010, when most of these college students, most of these millennials weren't even voting at that time.
Exactly. Exactly. But and like, so again, it's like, and the, so the way I would, you know, I think that we need to think about all this is to say, like, look, it's like, look, let's take it for, I believe, right, when Hillary Clinton says that she believes, you know, that America is somewhere between center right and center left, right, and that she's committed to that kind of position. I don't know what, the perfect center or something like that, right? Why don't we just take her at her word that that's what she believes, right? And leave it at that, right? So the reason why, you know, from us, from our perspective, why it looks like, you know, she's pandering to the Republicans, right, is because that was the playbook of the Democratic Party, right, since Bill Clinton was in office.
Yeah,
right. The idea was is that that's what he always would do. He would chastise, like the playbook was this, is that, you know, that like unions and civil rights organizations and all that have no place else to go. And that is exactly the words that Bill Clinton said.
It's a sister soldier moment. That sister soldier moment that
exactly.
What we call it, that Thomas Frank talked about, the Keystone Progress Summit.
Exactly. Right. So he can go after and he can, you know, say, look, I'm not afraid to go after my own kind of thing. Right. I'll go after Sister Soldier. I'll go after the unions. I'll go after all these folks because I know, you know, they got no place else to go. So they're going to vote Democratic anyways. Right. Now, what we're finding now is that, again, like I'm saying, that, you know, we watched the death throes of that whole movement and why I think Bill Clinton was so pissed off at those college students out in Harrisburg that day that, you know, you were there to see him say that, to chastise college students, was precisely because he recognized his power, his authority and his influence in the party was slipping away as he's watching it. Right. And the thing is that, I mean, you know, you got to say, if you want to have any sympathy for Hillary Clinton, right, is like to say that, well, look, you know, yeah, I bet it's hard for her personally that, you know, that the center of the Democratic Party is no longer there, that people have moved on and they don't want what she's selling, you know. Yeah, and I think it, you know, and I think it is unfortunate because I think, you know, if it's unfortunate in the sense that, you know, she really had a chance to kind of, you know, break that glass ceiling. And I think that would have been really significant kind of symbolically, you know, and practically speaking, too, as well across the country. But, the thing is, what we're seeing with Bernie Sanders and the single payer thing is like, man, you know, you've got the future powers of the Democratic Party are scrambling to make sure that they're on board with where the energy is.
And look at what he look at the movement that he sparked. You know, we were kind of talking about this in the Democrats when Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders isn't a Democrat, but this is our resort, our option of last resort. Like, you know what I mean? Yep. We as progressive have nowhere else to go. I mean, right? Last week I joined the Democratic Socialists of America. I joined the DSA because I know get my creds out there. But no, like I joined the DSA because like it's like I want my money going to an organization that is going to put that. It's going to do something in return.
Yep.
And like, look at what they're planning on fighting for, you know, mobilizing people. I mean, like, yeah, they only got like 25,000 members across the country, but you know what? They had 4,000 members before the election right. season. You know, like,
again, let's be clear here, is that what you're talking about and everything that's been happening in DSA, right, since the election, especially during the primary with Bernie Sanders, is that, okay, you might say 25,000 members, right? And that might say, oh, that's not very many people. But we're talking about activists in every community,
yeah,
right? We're talking about people who like, do that work.
Our Harrisburg DSA chapter has anywhere between 10 or 20 members who are with that. And that's enough people, 20 people in a city this small, to actually get stuff done and force things to the table within the city council or within the county. Mm-hmm. That's the type of the reason why I look at it like that. You know, like, yeah. And you know what? We're it's like the organizing going on. You know, this actually could be a network of groups that could be bigger within central Pennsylvania.
Well, exactly. And I'll use this opportunity, anybody listen to this, who's in the Upper Bucks area, Doylestown area, or up in Lehigh Valley, right, looking to kind of put together a chapter of DSA, please hit me up. Because this is one thing, what I'm so psyched about, you see this out in Harrisburg, is because the locus of politics, historically, progressive politics in the state, as I've said this multiple times, has been in like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and everyone, the rest of the state gets left. And, you know, I've purposely not gone and kind of try to, you know, build those kind of connections, or say, I'm going to go to these meetings, say the Philadelphia chapter, because I don't think that's where my energy needs to be. Right. I mean, I think that we need it in Upper Bucks. We need it in Lehigh Valley, especially. So those folks who are floating around out there, they're looking for points of connection. Hit us up here at Raging Chicken and we'll get something moving.
Yeah, no,
No,
there
should
be a DSA chapter in every community, damn it.
No, exactly. And again, instead of the kind of the longing to be in Pittsburgh, the longing to be in Philadelphia or the kind of major population centers, we should be saying, no, we have to build in our communities. I mean, that was, you know, and this is the thing too, as well. I mean, just the way that we talk about Bernie, right? I think that we have to remember, right? I mean, you and I were there, right? We were there at the PA Progressive Summit before Bernie launched his campaign, and he was a keynote speaker, at the PA Progressive Summit or the Keystone Progress Summit, whatever the heck they're calling it now. He was a keynote speaker, and he basically said, you know, look, I'm listening, right? You know, I'm really considering a run, but I got to see if people are going to show up to do it, right? And he's consistently said, right, I'm not going to be your savior, right? This is about building a political movement. So anytime we say Bernie does, we got to remember that the only reason that Bernie ever ran, right, was because people were showing up in the streets. People were showing up at his thing and they were organizing. Right. So that, you know, as much as we say that Bernie helped make DSA, we have to remember that we made Bernie. Right. Because if Bernie has been saying these things for, you know, as long as his career, as we know, he said about single payer, free college tuition, about, you know, need to strengthen unions, all that kind of stuff. The only reason why the message resonated so much now is because we showed up. Right. And so we have to keep that on. And remember, never again should we ever make the mistake that was that happened in 2008 with the election of Obama, thinking that Obama was going to solve all the problems, right? If anything, what the lesson of Bernie Sanders should be is that when we organize and we push back, right, we gain power and we embolden those people, our representatives that are progressive, to do good things, just like we're seeing this week.
Yeah, and also, I mean, like, just what we've seen since Trump got elected with the Women March, you know, starting with the Women's March, you know, like, I don't think anyone thought that was going to be the largest protest in United States history, you know, moving on forward to fighting back the healthcare repeals, going out there, you know, supporting DACA, you know, this is a big organizing opportunity for the left. And, you know, it's an organizing opportunity for where groups like, you know, DSA will have more of an influence within local communities, within organizing circles too.
Yep. No, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I mean, it's incredible to see. You know, I was talking to my friend Stu out in Derry, Northern Ireland yesterday, and he said, "Man, what's going on with DSA?" Right? So it's kind of I barely even remember DSA when we were in college. I said, "Yeah, do you remember them in New York?" And he's like, "Yeah, the Socialist Scholars Conference, right?" we used to go to this conference every year down in New York. I think it was like Manhattan Bureau Community College or something. They used to have it there. And all these different kind of like socialist lefty groups would get together. It'd be like a conference, political conference there. And DSA always had its table, right? And the joke about DSA at that point, like among us, you know, we're kind of like punk rock radical kids, whatever, was kind of like, oh yeah, look, it's the nice socialists from the 60s who want to kind of keep things going. They got their card table, you know, and they're always like really pleasant and all this kind of stuff, but interesting and kind of informed and all that kind of stuff, but not like, you know, didn't have that, you know, that organizing edge, right? So we always kind of thought like, okay, they're just doing their thing. And what's great to see now, and Stu and I were talking about this, is like, you know, it's great to see now is that those people who've been basically, they've consistently been building that organization, right, and keeping it going, right, and keeping it go from now that you've got this influx of all these younger folks, right? And I think like Jacobin has really helped that along too as well.
Trap House.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing how like DSA was actually a group I was considered joining like 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I just never did it. I was like, whatever. But no, I did it because of how much influence like they've been getting. You know, like a lot of the people I see involved with that, like especially within the labor caucus, Eric Robertson from Teamsters 728 in Atlanta, Georgia, the statewide Teamsters union down there. Gabe Kramer from SEIU Healthcare in Pennsylvania, you know, like the Brett is somewhat involved with DSA. Winnie Wong, who does a lot of online social media stuff, you know, the people I see involved with the DSA are your prominent progressive activists that are out there today making a name for the movement, you know, and doing stuff on social media. And, you know, like, it's like these people get it. Like the reason why I join is because the people I see involved with it, they get it. And they're also like, they're great organizers in their own areas of expertise, whether it's on social media or it's organizing labor unions or getting involved with the movement back home. And it's like, you know, you have these people, this is a vehicle for these activists, these progressives from across the country to get together and to like organize, you know. Yeah. I joined the DSA. I consider myself a socialist. I've never read Marx. Like, I've just never bothered reading Marx, Trotsky, any of those Marxist theorists or anything like that, because it's just like, but I believe in more of like that social democratic view on things, like more of like your 1920s, 1930s New Deal Democrat, like those are the type of programs I believe in. And now it's like, you know, our discourse has gone so much to the right where believing in a 1920s, 1930s social democracy has you as a full-blown Marxist, which is not
right. Right. which is remarkable. But yeah, I mean, it's great to see. And it's great to see that, you know, when the opportunity arose, when, you know, there's an influx of kind of, you know, kind of new blood and young folks and stuff that want to join up, those people that have been kind of holding down the fort for, you know, for decades, have been more than happy. I mean, I'm sure there's internal conflicts, like there isn't any organization, but they've been, you know, gotten out of the way, the energy, so to speak, right? And let a lot of these folks that want to kind of grow this organization take, you know,
and it's
take
a representative over. Democratic organization where, you know, like a bunch of the people who got elected to the National Policy Committee have only been involved with the organization for like less than a year. So a lot of these people who are getting involved with the National Policy Committee, the steering committee for this organization, are new activists. And, you know, people who voted them in were the Democrat, like, no, in a Democratic fashion, people who voted them in were the millennials who joined, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, it operates like a union. It's a democratic operating,
that's right.
Democratically operating body.
No, it's right. And that's what's nice about that too, as well. Cause I remember, you know, again, when I was, you know, back in like, you know, high school and college and afterwards, a lot of socialist politics, you get kind of, you know, connected to some of these organizations, you see what things would be, you end up in these kind of like, ideological like purity battles. Right. And it was always a bit frustrating, right? Because instead of actually just kind of, okay, we may be coming at this one issue about, you know, what's the correct definition of the Soviet Union, right? Is it, you know, whatever, you know, what's the terminology for it? And look, I get it. Those things are important and all that kind of stuff. But to let that stand in the way about, you know, whether this group and that group are going to work together in order to kind of, you know, make sure that, I don't know, like there's clean water in a building in your town. You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, that used to drive me crazy. But what we're seeing now with the way that, you know, DSA has emerged as kind of like a kind of an organizing hub, and groups like Socialist Action too, as well, or Socialist Alternative, I should say, you know, have been willing to, you know, okay, let's let the democratic process work, and, you know, say we're not going to have an ideological purity test in order to be part of organization X or B, but we're going to actually bring this together so we can organize effectively. I mean, it's good to see.
Yep.
You see. Well, listen, so we didn't even plan to talk about DSA today. but I mean, I'm glad we did, because I think that it is, you know, the direction that things are going, and I'm liking it. One thing I should say, you know, just to kind of mention, I don't know how much we'll get, you know, we need to get into this, but, you know, I've been watching what's been happening in the aftermath of Harvey and Irma. And, you know, I'm taken back to Katrina, taken back to, you know, everything that Naomi Klein was talking about in the shock doctrine. And it looks like that's precisely what's getting rolled out now.
Yeah. Especially in Puerto Rico, where Puerto Rico's, the sharks have been going after Puerto Rico for quite some time now. And it seems like Irma is a vehicle with which they want to do that.
Yep, because they're going to sit there, what's going to be the solution? And, you know, for a while there, some of the political leadership in Puerto Rico has been all keen on this kind of these privatization schemes. They've been slowly, you know, again, this is stuff that Naomi Klein talks about in Shock Doctrine, this kind of like slow kind of defunding of the public sphere to make the public sphere work less well, so that people will kind of be more open to considering privatization schemes. And now that, you know, Puerto Rico was hit really hard by Hurricane Irma, they see this as now the time to jump. And I'm saying kudos to Kate Aronoff over at The Intercept. I mean, she just writes in these times and a bunch of other places, but she has seriously been tearing it up when it comes to you know, coverage of climate change and looking at what's been going on. It's been great to see that kind of coverage. You know, this piece that she just wrote for The Intercept, now comes the uncomfortable question, who gets to rebuild after Harvey? Super piece. Also something on the co-written with a couple other folks on the Puerto Rico privatization stuff is great. Go over there and check it out at The Intercept. And do not forget to check out Naomi Klein's piece there too as well. Oh, Irma won't wake up. Irma won't wake up climate change denying Republicans. Their whole ideology is on the line. Go read that. You'll see. And one of the things that I think that I appreciate so much about Naomi Klein's piece is, like, you know, direction that you see so many, say, Democrats going, right, who are all worried that they don't want to be perceived as using Irma or using Harvey for political purposes, right, by talking about climate change, right? That is the kind of crap that makes my head spin, right? Because it's not politics to talk about climate change, right? It's science, right? And the thing is that if you want to talk about solutions, yeah, then we're starting to talk about some of the differences. But by saying, look, we need to respond to this thing in climate change because of things like Irma, right? But what is happening right now in the mainstream media is, like, once again, like, you know, wanting to go to retreat from any discussion of climate change because they're afraid that the right wing is going to attack them. Right. As opposed to actually saying, no, this is precisely the moment when people are paying attention that we need to be talking about this stuff.
And then also, I guess one last thing on climate change, was something I saw read a couple times. There's a really great Democracy Now! Interview with the guy from Media Matters, I believe.
Yes. Yes.
Or Public Citizen. I forget which one it was. But one of these organizations sort of along the lines of Media Matters called out the news organizations. I think, like, only like 10 or 15 minutes worth of climate change discussion happened in the wake of Harvey and Irma in, like, on all the major media outlets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're not talking about the issue. And basically their argument was, you know, if you live inside the media bubbles that actually touched upon this, which is very few, yes, you'll get that message. But for everyone else who does not live within inside these media bubbles, who live outside those media bubbles, and when the major media outlets fail to recognize this issue, it goes unnoticed to pretty much like most of the population.
Yeah, absolutely. And that piece you're talking about too, yeah, you were right. It's Public Citizen. It's David R. Cush. He's the managing director of Public Citizen's Climate Change. He was on Democracy Now! We'll make sure to put a link of that into the show notes too, because they just released a new report, which is about all this. And again, goes right to the point that you were making that, you know, exactly. I mean, here you go. There?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, everybody. I thought it just cut out, but no. I just shut down the
Sean.
Oh man. You know, a couple other things that I thought was, you know, the last thing here on the climate change stuff. You just brought this up this morning. Looks like the Wall Street Bull took a little hit.
It took a little bit of blue paint.
Yeah, that was always good to see. It was funny. Somebody splashed blue paint all over the bull in protest of climate denial, and they put a blue ribbon on the fearless girl. That is the one, you know, that statue of the little girl who's standing there in defiance of the Wall Street Bull. So it's happening everywhere, on the streets all around. Have you followed any of this stuff too this week about the let me just mention this, and then I'm just more interested in what your take is on the Chuck and Nancy stuff. But before we get there, just to mention, Chris Kobach, he is the director of Trump's like fraudulent like voter fraud thing. Yeah, basically what he's doing, you know, following on Trump's claims that like millions of illegal or undocumented workers actually voted in the election. And that's what kind of why he didn't get the popular vote, blah, blah, blah. They've been running this thing. And so, again, it's just a sham. It's a complete sham. It's just all freaking filled with lies. But the only reason to pay attention to it, right, is that Chris Kobach has been rolling out basically I don't know. It's almost like market testing. Some of the solutions, quote unquote, that he plans on rolling out to suppress the vote in 2018 and 2020, right? Well, the one that you may have heard about was that they're trying to say, well, basically have to get background checks, just like they do when we're purchasing a weapon, right? They have to get background checks before they can vote, right? Which is, you know, talk about like, you know, the heavy-handed Big Brother state, right?
I know. I think this commission is one of the most dangerous things that's happened under Trump. They're consistently, you know, if you tell a lie enough times, it'll then become truth. And, you know, especially within that media realm, if you tell a lie about Trump's, you know, about 3 million illegal or undocumented immigrants voting enough many times, it's going to eventually become truth, and right. people in that media bubble, the Alex Jones media bubble, the far alt-right media bubble, not just the Fox News one, but like, you know, these are separate spheres within the right. It's going to become truth to them, and it already is.
Yep.
And that's the scary thing about all this with Trump, is how the far alt-right media sphere is just eating this stuff up and, you know, believing it to be true.
That's right. And that really is the agenda. I mean, if you look at, you know, people are looking at these polls that are out there about, you know, how popular Trump is and finding that he's at historic lows and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, again, those measurements are based upon a different political model, right? The model that Trump is doing is exactly what you're saying, right? It's like you have this hardened core, right, of Trump supporters that are infused with kind of white supremacy, this whole alt-right movement that have been, you know, steeped in Alex Jones for way too long, and they are not moving, right? And those are the people that they want to kind of keep in line and keep in place. They're the foot soldiers, right? And, you know, so then what do you do? How do you win like further elections or gain additional power when you represent only a quarter of the electorate? Well, what do you do is that you make the electorate smaller.
You get your tiki terrorist out on the streets. You know what I mean? You get your tiki terrorist out in the streets and they start beating people up.
Well, that's exactly. And you do something like this, like this morning, like we mentioned in the intro, is that there was a London, there was a bomb, it was kind of improvised bomb that went off on a London tube this morning. A bunch of people were, you know, treated for burns and stuff like this. When I was looking at first this morning before he went on the air, it didn't look like there had been any deaths, but I may be wrong about that at this point. But Trump used that as an opportunity to kind of want to talk again about, you know, justifying denying entry to people coming into the country from outside, shut down immigration basically, and visits from people from countries. So we're going to see a reemergence of that. So that's going to be their doubling down.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Crazy. So there's just that. Let me go back, just kind of close this out with a couple things. One, I'm just curious your take on the whole what's gone on this week with Trump courting Chuck and Nancy some more.
I don't know. I mean, you're going to take your victories where you can get them, but I don't know if you start. I don't know if you want to build an alliance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you can get DACA without having the wall being built, then yes, I think that's a deal worth taking. But yep. What does that do for him in the long run? Does that bolster his creds for reelection? Or does that, you know, piss off his base to the point where they don't want to come out and vote for him in 2020?
Yeah, you know what I would do, and I know, who knows, maybe she already did this, but so one of the things that apparently behind the closed door meetings took place, one of the things they said that basically, according to Nancy Pelosi, that Trump basically indicated that they would consider a Dream Act, right? Or that he would consider a Dream Act that would basically provide a path to citizenship, a whole bunch of stuff like this. So it would go well beyond DACA, and that he was open to that. And she went out and said that. And then Trump said, you know, no, it's not what I was saying, blah, 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 because he's worried about his base. And that just got me to think, like, well, you know, either she did that intentionally, right? Or she should do more of it, right? Basically, come out of these meetings with Trump and get him to say something in those meetings, because, you know, he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. So get him to say something in those meetings that kind of would, you could read or you could interpret that, is more progressive than he would like it to hear, that would alienate that the jump of voters, and keep on coming out and say, oh, yeah, we were surprised. President Trump seemed to be, you know, like all in favor of a path to citizenship, right? And then, because, you know, the kind of alt-right Twitter sphere kind of blew up after they heard that, you know, thinking that maybe what is Trump a turncoat and now things like this. And then Trump, of course, walked back some of the things he said because he was worried about alienating that base. And that's not a bad political strategy in my mind.
No, it's not.
Oh, crazy. Well, one last mention, too, again, is that we see Harvard indicates itself once again as a spineless university, especially when it comes to the administration there, as they invited Chelsea Manning to be a visiting fellow there. And then Mike Pompeo threw a hissy fit and refused to come and visit on Thursday. So, the dean over there said at the Kennedy School's Institute of Politics basically was like, well, sorry, Chelsea Manning, we know we sent you out the invite, but it was kind of a mistake. That invite was supposed to go to somebody else, right? We didn't even mean to send it to you. I know this is uncomfortable. But that was messed up.
Yeah, I'm sure if it went to a white nationalist or a white supremacist, everything would be fine, you know, because they love free speech.
Yeah, they love free speech, and they're a repressed minority at this point, right?
Yeah.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day 350,000 GM workers kicked off a 67-day strike. It was the largest auto strike since the end of World War II. According to historian Jefferson Cowie, it was likely the costliest. In his book, Stayin' Alive, Cowie notes that the strike cost GM $1 billion in profits and nearly bankrupted the union. But he adds it, quote, lacked the proletarian drama that fired journalists' hearts. For Cowie, it was an example of labor management cooperation, a civilized affair. But historian Jeremy Breacher points out that the Wall Street Journal drew different conclusions about the strike at the time. In a series of articles, the paper noted that labor management cooperation during the strike served, ironically, to get workers back to work. A long and costly strike served a number of functions. It wore down strikers' expectations. After 8 or 10 weeks, workers would be amiable to terms they initially rejected. It also provided an escape valve for built-up frustration over working conditions. And a long strike served to coalesce internal union factions around a common enemy, strengthening the union's leadership in the process. For management, a long and costly strike lent hope that workers would be reluctant to strike in the future. But Breacher notes these ideas about workers' motives nearly backfired. Strikers simply wouldn't budge on their demands. They made gains in wages, pensions, and cost of living allowances. And they were finally able to retire after 30 years. But critics argued the agreement fell short of initial demands, and workers lacked more say in the workplace. This would be a key issue in the many strikes and wildcats in the years to come. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, back once again with Sean Kitchen, muckraker in chief out there in Harrisburg. Sean, man, you know, once again, we get booted off the internet after my phone overheats, but glad we were able to get it back. And so I want to turn to a little some stuff that's got some interesting intersections here with PA politics and some stories that you've been covering.
I guess we should start off with David Freed, Cumberland County District Attorney, is getting nominated to the U.S. Attorney's Office as U.S. Attorney General for the Mid-State Regional Office for Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania's Middle District.
Ah, good. So why do we care about this dude?
Because this is the guy who claimed that he didn't know that a neo-Nazi was volunteering in his office as a law clerk.
Yeah, and so you have one of two things here, right? So this is a story that Sean has been kind of reporting on, and so here's this guy, right? You got David Freed, right? He's Cumberland County DA. Was so clueless to know that the guy, what's the dude's name again? I'm sorry, I'm horrible.
Evan McLaren.
McLaren was a kind of white nationalist, alt-right, white supremacist, whatever the hell you want to call these people. While everybody else seemed to know, but this guy either had his head down and he's like, oh, I don't pay attention, which is, again, questionable is why you'd want to nominate this guy, or he's got his little binders full of white supremacists that he's ready to kind of go up there and start staffing up there in the district attorney's office.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do think it's like a legitimate claim that he didn't know this guy was volunteering in his office because like they wouldn't interact with each other. But it's kind of I think that's not an excuse for this position. Like someone was saying, Dennis Owens, local 27 reporter out here in Harrisburg, was saying, well, David Freed didn't know. OK, well, I didn't know is not an excuse. Like that's like the good Germans saying, I didn't know what that camp was down the street. There was just a bunch of people working in fields. Like, you know what I mean?
Yep. Like, well, I mean, and then at the very least, right? So let's give him the benefit of the doubt saying that he actually didn't know. Right. Let's just say that for a second. Even then, at this point, OK, now what does he have to say about it?
Yeah. And this right? is still like a political scandal. Like, David Freed was supported by Bob Casey and Pat Toomey to do this before. Like, I'm sure they did not know about this. And two of the things here. In 2008, Bob Casey was attacked viciously, or 2009, 2010, about an Obama nominee who represented Mumia Abu-Jamal for a civil rights case, where Mumia Abu-Jamal was, you are constitutionally granted protection, representation for your defense, no matter how heinous the crime is. You are protected by the Constitution, where this lawyer was doing his constitutional duty in representing Mumia. And Casey came out against him, right? This is a lot worse than that. This isn't like someone protecting someone's constitutional rights to a defense. This is someone who had a neo-Nazi working within his office and he did not know about it. which I kind of find it hard to believe because just hearing secondhand talk from people who have friends in that office, everyone knew that this guy McLaren was whacked out of his mind. And
well, and that's the thing, right? The question is, how does he get hired? And like, what does it say about what's going on in that office? Right.
And so, so The Intercept reports on this, not about David Freed getting nominated, but about Evan McLaren and his support for white nationalism goes back to 2008, 2009. And, you know, there's a bunch of online stuff he never scrubbed off the internet where he's saying highly racist shit going back to that time. So if you did a simple like Google search of this guy, put this guy's name into a search engine, you would have figured out who he was and what he was doing. And, you know, I find complete bullshit with his ties going back that far, right? Going back 10 years almost, that I find it complete bullshit that like no one knew about this guy being a white supremacist, especially right. Him being active within the local party. Sorry, not buying it. This person was involved with white supremacy, the alt-right, with Richard Spencer for close to 10 years now. And you're going to tell me that never really he never showed his true colors or the hood never went on. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
like I find it disingenuous to believe that the people within the local Republican Party did not know about him or his reputation.
Yeah, well, here we have it. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what goes on. So is there, as far as you know, are there any kind of timelines of when we can expect any hearings?
I'm not too sure about that. And also one of the things we got to say about David Freed in his office, civil asset forfeiture has been a big issue with the ACLU of Pennsylvania over the past couple of years, doing reports on that, trying to get that to become illegal in Pennsylvania, where civil asset forfeiture, for anyone who doesn't know, you get pulled over by a cop, you have drugs in your car, the cop is able to seize your property under suspicion that you're used, that those drugs are for transport or sale or for drug dealing. So you can lose out on money for that, right? They've used civil asset forfeiture as a ratio as 18 to 1 against black residents of Cumberland County to white residents of Cumberland County.
Yep, there you go. I mean,
and for anyone who doesn't know, there's a lot of white people doing heroin in Cumberland County. You just go right over the bridge where I'm at. You know, people like to talk about Harrisburg, the West Shore, East Shore, the West Shore being the White Shore, and the East Shore being where all the black people live. You know, there's a lot of heavily concentrated drug areas within the White Shore across the bridge from where I live.
Yeah, and you know where I guarantee he's not prosecuting and they're not going out and searching for stuff? College campuses, right?
Yeah, they're certainly ain't going to Dickinson Law School in Carlisle or Shippensburg to look for these drugs.
Right, exactly. That's the playbook, man, right there. We'll see where this is going to go, because you know, like, again, I was like, this is what happens, folks, when you pay attention, like Sean does. Right? You start saying, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? And we see, you know, and again, you know, again, even under the most generous interpretation, right, it's hard to kind of fathom. So why is it that the Trump administration is tapping this guy?
I mean, yeah. It just so happens like two or three weeks after this political scandal is broiling in his own backyard, he gets nominated to become the middle district U.S. attorney for Pennsylvania.
Right. And I think, you know, for me, it stands out as like, hey, you know what? We've got a pipeline to an office in Pennsylvania that has harbored our kind of good alt-right friends. And so, you know, maybe you should give this guy a look, Mr. Trump.
Yeah.
Crazy, man. That's crazy, crazy, crazy. So in other news, we've got we'll continue to follow that one. But in other news, our good boy Tommy Wolf have a little, I don't know, identity crisis right now, because, I mean, does he, you know, is he going to throw in behind the frackers, or is he going to, you know, I don't know, grow an environmental skin here? Because we see they just came out and voted for a moratorium against fracking in the Delaware River Basin Commission. What's going on with that?
So a story was published in State Impact NPR. And Pennsylvania NPR project about Governor Wolf last week or a couple days ago, where Governor Wolf would support revoking, pulling the moratorium back in 2005 2015, the moratorium of fracking moratorium in the Delaware River Basin. If the landowners, county officials, and state lawmakers provided him a severance tax. So this story was published the day before the vote, where he was willing to vote against this fracking ban within the Delaware River Basin Commission if they provided him the votes and the material needed for a statewide severance tax, which has not happened yet. So the next day after the story was published, Governor Wolf votes in favor with Maryland, Delaware, and New York, or no, not Delaware, Maryland, or no, not Maryland, but with Delaware and New York to keep a ban on fracking within the Delaware River Basin Commission, within the Delaware River Basin, which provides clean drinking water for tens of millions of people in this region.
Right.
And this was this is one of the main issues that Josh Fox, what prompted him to make Gasland, was the potential fracking within this river basin.
Well, what's interesting about that, though, so you're saying, though, that if he basically had gotten his severance tax, then he most likely would have voted the other way?
If he would have gotten a severance tax in 2015, yes, he would have voted the other way probably by now, before this vote even happened.
Wow.
Yeah. And then another thing we found this week, forgot to mention in the show notes, but Michael Krancer, former DEP secretary, is representing a company that was started by Terry Pegula, who has a ice hockey rink at Penn State named after him. Mm-hmm. His company is now fracking within the Utica Shale, which is 3,000 to 7,000 feet deeper than the Marcellus Shale. So now we're already seeing moves being made to frack the Utica Shale, which is going to be more extreme intensive. They need more technology to develop this, and it's starting to happen now. And also, this company will have 12 operating wells by the end of 2017. And what's really peculiar, the day that Krancer took on this company, I think it's JKLMG. I believe I don't have it right in front of me right now. The day he took on this company is the day that company, it came out in local reports that company polluted a bunch of water wells in a part of Pennsylvania through their fracking practices. So it's definitely a story to look into.
Oh man, I'm glad you brought that up, because we talked about that earlier, and then that's a big deal. I mean, the Utica Shale. I mean, I remember this is early on in
Utica Shale dwarfs. The Utica Shale dwarfs the Marcellus Shale in size.
Well, not just in size, but also in the kind of difficulty and the extreme kind of extraction measures that it's going to take. Right. So, I mean, not only so you're talking about this enormous kind of region, but it is so deep that, you know, you're going to need even more extreme measures to get that out. So this is the double problem that we get when we've got a governor, a Democratic governor, who is basically throwing in with the oil and gas industries. Is that we're talking about, you know, ramping up greenhouse gases and ramping up extractivism at precisely the time that, you know, we should be going a complete opposite direction. So, I mean, at least we got this one little tiny victory with Tom Wolf voting for the moratorium. But for the rest of the state, it's like, you know, out to the wolves, I guess.
And also, it shows you that a former public official, former Secretary of the Defense Department of Environmental Protection, is now profiting off of the drilling, the extreme extractionism of this, right. This industry.
Yeah, right. There's that too, right? It's like, and not only that, you got the guy who was running the agency is now turning around and kind of, cashing in on his time there. It's just, it's crazy.
Yeah. So
crazy, man. And then we also got, apparently, PA House Republicans are, trotting out their unicorns this week.
Yeah, and Grover Norquist was in the House, supposedly.
You said that earlier the week, man. Norquist was in the House. Norquist in the House!
And the Republicans, the House Republicans, the Kamikaze Caucus.
The Kamikaze Caucus. That's awesome.
The Freedom Caucus, our Freedom Caucus here, they were able to pass a House budget by one vote. It passed by one vote. And basically a bunch of one-time transfers. The same shit they've given us the past 3 years, the same shit sandwich. And now it also provides one of the largest cuts in history to environmental programs, $317 million cuts to environmental programs that have been cut by at least 40% over the past 10 years. So it's just taking more money out of these cuts. And Joe Markosik, one of our spineless Democratic leaders, actually had something fun to say about this. He said, unicorns and rainbows are what this budget plan is all about, except at the end of this rainbow, we don't have unicorns. We have acid rain and contaminated water.
I'd like to see what those leprechauns look like. It's like it's kind of like the leprechaun meets insane clown posse, right? That's what's at
well,
the end
they, of they are having their million juggalo march coming up this week.
Oh, and the alt-right apparently is going to meet them for some sort of, like, I don't know, made for late night TV B movie like confrontation.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's absolutely crazy. I think that, you know, this one of the things that stood out to me too, Sean, is that when you were looking at those, the kind of provisions that the PA Republicans are basically, you know, trying to pull their smoke and mirrors over are the exact same things that the S&P, right, and other crediting agencies kind of indicated are the things that will cause PA to lose more of its status and credit, that will basically downgrade our credit rating even further, because they've been recognized as, you know, been pointed out as that these are the kinds of things that are not sustainable and are going to cause further crisis. So on the one hand,
it's like the thing is that they're doing this in the guise of saving taxpayers money, right? But these credit downgrades, these like failing bond downgrade, these credit downgrades and these bond ratings that we're going to be getting will cost the taxpayers more than just raising the taxes right now.
Yep.
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. We're like, if we didn't have a Democrat governor right now, we would be Kansas.
Like, no, exactly. Exactly.
Like we would be like the Kansas child in Northeastern United States.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, as much as, you know, again, let's be clear about that, is that that's the one thing that is good. So we're happy. Let's say we are happy that Tom Wolf is sitting there in the governor's office right now because he's the only stopgap. Right. But mean that Tom Wolf then gets a free pass on everything else. So let's just be clear about that. Because, yes, I mean, look, we can point to the fact that, look, he's the only thing that has been prevented, like an abortion ban for going in, going into law, from a whole bunch of other legislation to get
right
through
to work that legislation.
And so let's be clear, right, that that's been huge victories, or at least he's done well as a stopgap measure for those things. But that doesn't mean that, you know, he gets a pass on absolutely everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious, is there, so you've got this, you know, anyway, I should say, you know, no surprise that Grover Norquist shows up when he does, right? Because he shows up precisely, he's not showing up there to help, you know, to see what's going on. He's showing up as a threat. Right, he's going around to those people who might be wavering about, you know, their status on, you know, the no tax pledges and things like this, to make sure that they know that if, you know, raise taxes, then he's going to start let that Coke money flow in order to primary these folks in their upcoming elections. So he's there as a threat, you know, in the Capitol building.
Yeah, yeah, man, someone who has crazy, no connection, man, to Pennsylvania at all.
Yeah, well, you know, money is free to reign everywhere, Sean. You know, it's no borders, man. No borders. So, all right. So anything else going on in the state?
The Senate comes back next week to deal with the shit sandwich they've been dealt.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, do you think that there's a chance that they're actually going to push this thing through? I mean, I look at this, I'm saying, look, the Senate comes back. They're going to have to reconcile.
Like completely re-amend the bill and just send it onto the governor's desk.
Can they do that?
I'm not sure. It might have to go to a conference committee.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll see. I look at this as just going to be more more pain, right? More pain ahead for us. And you know, again, you know, and the sad part about that is that
this bill right here is what the Commonwealth Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, what the this is what the Koch brothers, these Koch brother groups, AFP in Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth Foundation, and anyone else in that manufacturer's building. Like, yes, there is a brick and mortar capital, right? But yep. Real capital is across the street on State Street inside the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association building. That is where they get their marching orders from. And this is the exact same budget these people have been pushing for the past 6-7 weeks now, like these cuts that they've been looking for, right? What they want to do, their end goal here, what the Americans for Prosperity and the Commonwealth Foundation's their end goal is to take another $1 billion out of public education. Yep. Is to take hundreds of millions of dollars out of infrastructure and the environment. Like this is their goal right now.
Yep, there it is. I mean, they're going to get it one way or another unless we kind of have any kind of organized resistance to it, because you know, one, they're going to push this kind of bill through, cause all sorts of pain, right? And just what you described, or it's going to lead to more ongoing arguments and debates and things like this. Well, meanwhile, there's not enough money in the coffers to get us through without a tax increase. So it'll happen anyways, right? Just a question of what is the painful version that we're going to take, right? The only thing is, man, people are going to start pushing back hard.
Bring out your dad.
Bring out your dad. It is. We are living inside a Monty Python skit. I'm telling you, man. All right. Well, gonna, you know, have to keep on plugging along and see what we can do, man. I'll tell you, man, this whole internet thing is really freaking bumming me out. I'm just realizing it right now. It's making things harder than it needs to be, but whatever, you know, because that's the world we live in. And because Verizon is, you know, has basically announced that it is throttling everyone, I'm sure that because I'm kind of working off my little cell phone, that I'm probably going to be at a crawl, right, for the next 7 weeks after doing this podcast. So, yeah, like, so whatever, man. Everything's good.
So like, all right. So I have a quick Verizon story before we break. I was paying for 15 up, right, uh-huh. or 15 down. When I left Verizon for Comcast cable, mm-hmm. I made the switch. It's like picking which like evil thing you want to do business with the most. I was getting like 7 down by the time I left Verizon. They were throttling my network so hard. And when I went to Comcast, I went right to like 35 down.
There you go.
And I was just like, and the phone call they're trying to like persuade me not to like switch providers. I'm like, yeah, no, they're coming out in like 10 minutes. Like they're on their way. Sorry, I'm done. Like they're like, well, you do know, like you're pooled together with everyone else, and with you, you get your own bandwidth. I was like, yeah, I was paying for 15 down. I'm only getting 10 or 8 on a good day. Sorry, done. And they just like, and I hung up the phone. I was like, I wanted to turn it off, and I just hung up the phone on them.
Yeah. Yeah, there you have it, man. Verizon, man. It's a big question. All right, we're going to come back right after this. We're going to close out with a quick last call, and we'll see if we can get this podcast up somehow later on today. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them.
Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coup podcast. It is last call today on the podcast. We're going to make it a quick one today. One, I wanted to give a plug out to Chris Robay. Chris Robay was out at Kutztown University yesterday giving a talk, and he was at Lehigh University the day before. He's got this awesome new book out. It's called Breaking the Spell, A History of Anarchist Filmmakers, Videotape Guerrillas, and Digital Ninjas. And I talked with Chris for a while, and we're actually going to try to get him on the program for an Out to Coop Extra as an interview. And what I didn't know when he was first coming in is that a portion of the research he does for this book is from folks down at the Media Mobilizing Project down in Philadelphia, which was kind of cool to hear yesterday. So the big section in the book about that. But basically what he's doing, he's tracking the kind of use of video and activism since about the 1960s. And why I think it would be really useful to have him on the program is, number one, talking about the role of media in kind of social movements and struggle. But also he kind of goes to a point that this show we've been talking about is that, you know, he said a lot of the right, this kind of activist thing is people don't remember their roots, right? Because you have these kind of fits and starts of activism. And so he basically charts the linkages between, you know, these kind of radical video practices from the 1960s through, and talks a lot about the indie media movement around the turn of the century and some of the influences that has had on a variety of other spaces. So it was a great talk. I got to see him at Kutztown, and so we hope to get him on the program. So that's just shout out to him. We're going to put a link to his book in the show notes. I think it'll be a lot of interest to many of our listeners. So the other thing I got to say is that the biggest thing about losing my internet the past couple days was the fact that Cassini, right? You remember Cassini, the probe, the satellite that's been around Saturn. Cassini is gone now, right? Cassini plunged. We talked about this on the show last week. Was plunged into the Saturn's atmosphere and it'll be gone forever. It was broadcast live over NASA last night and then early this morning. The images are starting to come back too as well. So we'll have the final images of Saturn from Cassini. I know it's a small thing, Sean, but it still has a place in my heart.
What's that?
Sean fell asleep again. Yeah, exactly. Well, okay, we'll wake you back up. So the last thing is I'll say about, you know, and kind of the space news for the day is this was just pure unadulterated fun. The SpaceX just released, like, for all practical purposes, like a bloopers reel that was like a compilation of all the failures to launch, so to speak, before it, you know, it kind of really perfected its process. And it was kind of this kind of an interesting reminder of how much has gone into kind of doing that and how much, you know, and all that kind of work. And it's just fun to watch, actually, you know, watching rockets blow up. In the meantime, you know, I'm thinking like, yeah, there you go. Oh, you know what that's kind of like? That's kind of like North Korea, right? They came out launching these rockets and some of them crashed, but now they're actually throwing them over Japan every day, something we didn't talk about today, but whatever. The big news, really, I mean, this is all the space news, just all the big lead up to, I mean, we got some major news today, which is that apparently Sean may get his big break as a hand model. because his hand made it into a crawler video, right? I had to wait to broadcast today because Sean had to watch it, and, you know, to see if he can pull his stuff out. So,
thank you. Yes. So PenLive put a video together over at Al's last week of the five beers to have for tailgating at Penn State. games. So for those who you don't know, Penn State's maybe like an hour and a half away from here. And Friday night gets mobbed when there's a home game, Saturday home game, because of all the people passing through from Philadelphia, like Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, all the people coming up for the home games. And they all seem to want to stop in at Al's and grab beer. So one of the videos they ran was the five beers to get at Pizza Boy or Al's of Hampton for tailgating. So and I was pouring crowlers.
And his hand made it in. So everybody look for the video that Sean will be tagging later on on his hand. Maybe we can put a picture up, Sean. We can circle your hand in it to make sure everybody knows that that is indeed your hand.
Well, actually, I'm quite happy. Like, my face wasn't in the video.
Oh, man.
So I wouldn't have spotted where I work by some fascist or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah, true enough. All right. Well, anything else going on out there in the kind of world of beer and fun?
Nothing right now. I've been drinking an insane amount of Cloudy with a Chance of Charcuterie the past couple nights.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yes. Yes. I walked into the bar.
Special out there in Harrisburg. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, it was on special for every day. The happy hour is special. But bar across the street from me, got a really good cook. The food's getting amazing now. It's like he probably like one of the best cooks in the city or the region they hired. So it's gone from the dingy like dive bar wing joint to like actually having like awesome food within the past month. So last night I walked in, grab a wrap, and I was like, well, what's on special? Wraps. It's after I ordered my wrap. I'm like, all right. And I was on my second beer. I was like, what's on special? It's like, what you're drinking, the freewheel stuff. And I'm like, all right, it's a good night.
What started as a nice little stop in for a little bite to eat turned into a celebration.
But the free will chance with a Cloudy with a Chance charcuterie was $3. So had a couple of them and went to bed.
And they are good. And they are good. Well, cool. All right, folks. Well, we're going to try to cut this one out and see if we can get it up later on this afternoon. Hopefully, the quality hasn't been too bad for y'all. I appreciate you sticking with us. And, you know, hopefully we'll be back, we'll back full throttle next weekend. Well, Sean, any big plans for the weekend?
No, nothing really.
Either. I get to go over to my kids' school for a little bit. They're doing a luncheon on the green, so kind of hang out and have lunch with the kids, and then home and wait for the Verizon guy to see if they can get this thing fixed. So we'll see. Keep your fingers crossed, man.
All right.
So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Just as a reminder, right, if you can, right, step up to the plate, folks, and become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the support and membership tab. You'll be on your way. We appreciate all our members. We're literally like just a stone's throw away from meeting our first goal, so we can pay our members more. We may have some additional news. I might have a lead on someone to bringing an additional writer on. We'll see if we kind of lock that down. I'll have that announcement coming next week. Sean and I had a great discussion with Justin Schweitzer earlier on this week. Justin is our current first ever student fellow from Kutztown University. And we had a good conversation with Justin this week. His work that he's been publishing in Raging Chicken so far already is awesome. So look more of his stuff too as well. So anyways, I'll bid you farewell, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We are out of here for the weekend.